So, Joe, you started talking about Waitress on Twitter, and then everybody was suddenly going to it.
Friday night might have been the night that they invite press to it.
Oh, okay.
So I just like bit the bullet on Friday night and I bought one single ticket to it for a couple weeks from now. So
Okay.
because I always end up with this thing where like the Tony Awards happen and it's just like, oh God, I didn't see that. I didn't see that. And I didn't see that. And I wanted to like, I feel very deficient. So.
Unless I magically win the Hamilton lottery, the Tonys are going to mean nothing because they're so obviously going to get nominated in every category and sweep.
Yeah.
But I did see The Crucible.
I've heard that's very good.
I enjoyed it quite a bit. It's like one of my favorite plays when I read it, when I was young. And
Right.
even though I love it, I always have trouble with Abigail.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she's.
I mean,
You
the
mean no matter
character.
who plays her, or you mean the
Yeah,
character?
whoever plays with the character is impossible.
Oh, yeah. Fuck her.
I mean, there's just no, like, I don't get, it seems to be a role that actresses want to play, but I'm not sure it's ever flattering to anyone. Not just because the character's unlikable.
Well, she just sort of, she doesn't go from anywhere to that, right? She
Yeah.
starts off being scheming and underhanded and.
Saoirse fares better than Winona, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
Well,
Oh.
I mean, don't make me say it. But our podcast lovely Sophie Okonedo,
Oh, right.
she's good, but I even during that final monologue, I just Joan Allen was so powerful in that movie
Yeah.
that it's like even though the movie's not good, I can't that role I always think of every line the way, exact way that Joan Allen said it.
Yeah. Don't we all think of most things with Joan Allen that way? Like, oh, I just rather imagine Joan Allen playing this role.
Like this conversation right now. I mean, like myself, I'm a role in it.
That's how you listen to us whenever we do these podcasts.
That's why I have trouble telling you all apart.
Welcome back to the podcast.
What season is this for us?
We go back as far as the Avatar year, right? We weren't podcasting for
Yes.
Slumdog Millionaire, or else we'd all remember that. Like, there would be some
That's
sort of
true.
scar.
Up that Derek has put this list of DVDs on the table that he wants to finally watch, which is always what happens when I go away for at least a week. Like, suddenly he wants to watch movies. I don't totally understand it. And one of the movies he wants to see is Slumdog Millionaire. And I'm like,
Oh.
honey, no.
Or you
Don't
could
do this
just
to
say,
us.
do it while I'm gone.
Well, which I was for 3 weeks, right? Like, what is happening? So last night he put it in and we started watching it. And it is like as abject as I remember. And he clearly thought this was going to be one of those moments where I was too hard on a movie and it's actually fine. And I was trying to, he was like, how did this win so many Oscars? And I was trying to explain that that was like a Ted Cruz, Donald Trump situation where when you had Benjamin Button and Slumdog, like you just wanted to kill yourself. Like there was no good outcome to sort of choose there. But he quit after half an hour, which means we have to watch the rest today. So this conversation is for sure the best thing that will happen to me today.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. That's my tale of woe.
Although you guys, that was the Taraji P. Henson Oscar nomination season.
Oh, it was. It was also the five people presenting
Exactly.
the Oscars. Yeah, there was some stuff there.
Right. But
There was the Peter. Wait a year.
that happened the
That happened
following
before.
year too.
It did. It sure did. And
Because
then
yeah, but not
never.
as well. Not with only former winners from the right category. I mean, I understand it produced Jeff Bridges, Michelle Pfeiffer, so it was great, but it wasn't the same as Goldie Hawn being like, Taraji, me.
You guys don't even understand. Michelle Pfeiffer and Julianne Moore on the stage next to each other.
Oh, do you remember that like 60 people texted you at once and like
It's remarkable that I didn't experience the rapture right then and vanish
know, I
forever.
know. I said, do you think they'll ever do that again?
No.
Yeah.
I think it ate up too much time, and it was probably that particular producer's like pet idea.
Right.
They all want to make their mark.
This is true.
And I mean, that could make a mark all over me with that. I'd be happy to see it again and again.
That sounded.
Said Monica Lewinsky.
My God. Speaking of making a mark all over us, everybody wants some. No? No? Bad transition?
Beautiful transition. I just saw it yesterday. I am happy to report that I kind of loved it.
I loved it. I really, really liked it a lot. Ooh,
that's exciting.
It's one of those Richard Linklater movies where it's sort of just like the poetry of people who are nothing like me. And that's always been my weird relationship with Dazed and Confused, too, where it's just sort of like, these people aren't me, and yet I'm seeing so much of like my life and my upbringing and myself sort of in these people, but at really odd angles, which... And he does that sort of time and again with, like, the Before Sunrise series and even in Boyhood, where it's just, like, his experiences are never filtered through people who I'm like, oh, yeah, that's me. And yet he gets to these sort of semi-universal things. And, like, the fact that he does that in Everybody Wants Some via the lens of this, like, 80s sex comedy.
About a baseball team.
Yeah, about a baseball team in Texas.
Which I didn't even know that it was about a baseball team.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's pretty remarkable. And it's just so, it felt very sort of easy breezy in the way that, like, a spring movie should feel. You know what I mean?
Right. I always feel like an anthropologist when I'm seeing his movies for the exact reasons you're describing. And not even like I'm not allowed to be there and I'm spying. It's more like I've been invited in.
It feels welcoming. It doesn't feel insular or...
This is so relaxed from, like, the beginning to... And not in the lazy way of you've seen it all before from him. You have seen it before from him, but his ease with the material and with that sort of observational, like, chill, like, comedy is pretty amazing. Like, I'm sure everybody's missing the fabulous scene after the credits, too.
I totally missed it. I left. I was at BAM, and the seats at BAM are too uncomfortable, so I just had to get up and leave.
It's all the way after the credits are over, and then you get a whole musical number.
My God, it's your dream.
Right? That even helped digest Slumdog Millionaire. Sorry, Nick.
Oh my God.
That's true. That is the best part of that movie, is the credits of that movie.
Because it's
and
over.
Not just because it's over.
So, sometimes with his movies... Even the ones I like, I wish that the filmmaking felt like maybe kind of interesting. Does that feel at all true in any way in this one?
Yeah, I mean, it's not any, you know, leap forward for him in that regard. Like, this is a really bad comparison because their moods aren't similar, but, you know, the Altman-esque sort of panorama, like, there's a lot of characters a lot of times in the frame, which I love, you know. So you can, you know, pick where you're looking, you know.
That's cool. I'm
like
into
so
that.
So many party scenes.
Yeah, it's kind of structured in these sort of three parties and then two sort of like destinations that they go to in the span of, I think it's just 2 days, right? It's just basically, it's the weekend before school starts.
Right.
And it kind of progresses from like more recognizable when it's just like, oh, it's the baseball house. And then by the end, they end up at, like, the drama kids' house, which is, I didn't go to a school with a significant drama program, so, like, maybe I'm off base, but, like, it's...
Honey, you've made up for it, okay?
Yeah, yeah. But it feels like that was what he had the least grasp on in terms of realism, because this sort of, this drama house feels very produced in a way that everything else feels very kind of easy.
I did love that the ending, this is not really a spoiler because the experience of watching it is the movie rather than the story.
Yeah.
But the ending has like a sort of Boyhood similarity, actually.
That's
the
a good point.
The last it felt really Boyhood to me, like the sort of like open-ended, you know.
Yeah.
It's all about like sort of like you're about to step into your real life.
Right.
And what will that be like? So much of coming age stories are about like that universal experience, whereas that's really the beginning of people's stories, and they really usually don't even hint that there's a future after that.
Right, because the coming of age feels like an end point rather than
right.
Whereas
really that's just the prologue, you know, to life.
And he tends to do that fairly well in that he'll leave his movies off with a lot of sort of story left to go. I mean, that was sort of that's what was characteristic of the Before Sunrise movies entirely, was that sort of this goes on and keeps going, and yeah. He also gets good performances out of actors who don't have a ton of experience. Like, half that cast was basically in their first major movie.
Or second, you know, like...
Or second, yeah.
Yeah, they're all fairly new, or people who haven't been great before.
Yeah. Like, who I are mean, you thinking of when you say that?
I mean, he's very, very, like, ridiculously attractive, but Tyler Hoechlin...
Yes.
He's been a little bit lacking in the acting department before, but I thought he was really good in this.
Yeah, yeah. You know who I think is legitimately, honestly, very good? And I used to just say this because I love the Step Up movies, but I think Ryan Guzman is actually a really good actor and could see some stuff from him. And he's also ridiculously attractive, which doesn't hurt. But
I mean,
that's
like
the Boy Next Door?
Yes, that's The Boy Next Door.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Glenn Powell, who I adored on Scream Queens, and that was such like a specialty kind of genre thing for people who were like either, you know, out on the just from the concept of it. But I think if you watch that show, he clearly was the standout of that cast, and he's so, so, so good in this as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that we've seen him before, but I was so in love with Wyatt Russell.
Oh yeah,
like
which
as
I,
much
it took
as I was
forever
in,
to realize who he was.
Yeah, as much as I was in 22 Jump Street, which is I think the first time I saw him, even though he'd been in a few other things.
But, he was really he and Jillian Bell were the two real reasons to see 22 Jump Street, which was a movie that in general sort of bummed me out. But yeah, Wyatt Russell's real good.
Yeah,
and I keep forgetting who like that he's Goldie and Kurt's kid.
Yeah. And it's because like,
he just sort of because he has such like a he has such an Owen Luke Wilson vibe that I always feel like where how is he related to those two? And it's just like no, he's that's not how he's related to famous people.
But I mean, it's actually like really fun because he looks so much like Kurt Russell, but then he's got like the Goldie hair.
Yeah. Right.
So.
So is one of these five pit stops in the movie a sex party? Just because you're telling me who's in the movie, and I'm just wondering.
They're all sex parties.
And yet, I was going to say, and yet the whole thing is kind of a sex party, just in the fact that, like, they're sort of intermittently kind of shirtless or wearing baseball pants, or sometimes both, and it's there's not a lot of, like, actual explicit nudity, but there's a whole lot of just, like, we're going to let you imagine, you know, this scene with just, like, 25% less clothes than there are, and you'll be all the way there.
Oh, the title making more sense.
Right.
Yeah.
That second exclamation point, I'm getting it.
Yes, that's exactly what it's for. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. This is TMI, but I took one of my friends who was newly single, and
that's dangerous. Yeah. You should put a ring on that for the newly single.
And he always orders these, like, huge tubs of popcorn with the refills, you know? And then the popcorn was, like, gone, so it was time to, like, refill it. And he, like, leaned over to me. He's like, I actually can't get up to go get the popcorn.
Oh, he didn't have a binder to put in front of him?
No.
Boy, that should go on the poster.
Right.
Well, I mean, how else are you going to meet people in a movie theater? Look at that.
Listen, they know. They've seen people walking out of that theater before. The people at the concessions, they'll know exactly what movie you're watching. So
that's right. Midnight Special.
Yeah. Midnight Special is the one we've all seen, right? That's our common ground.
Yes, yeah. And I will just, you know, spoiler alert, I hated it, actually.
Oh, you hated it? That's interesting.
Wow.
Yeah.
I feel like I was more crestfallen by the ending, but I generally was liking it up until then. And I think Nick, you tweeted about sort of admiring its ambition.
Yeah.
And I think that's definitely where I'm at. And I feel sort of a little protective of it because I feel like I did like so much of the early part of it. But I'm interested to hear, Nathaniel, why you hated it.
Well, many good stories start in media res, you know.
Yes.
And that's a great way to start because it's hooky, you know, and the audience is right with you because they're like, I want to know what's going on. And so this actually starts with the car zooming down the road, and they're clearly already on the run. And so then you're, like, waiting to catch up. But my objection to it is, like, the longer the movie went on, the more I realized he had no grasp of, like, sort of, like, you know, the structure of doing that is at some point the audience needs to catch up. And every single time we were introduced to any factor that was in play, like this sort of like weird, you know, cult of people, everything was so vague that I always felt behind the movie. Like it was missing crucial scenes, or he just thought it was enough to give me like a suggestion of something. But when you're dealing with something this weird and specific, I feel like you need some specificity. And it just, like, none of it told me anything at all. It was just like watching, it was kind of like in a blockbuster in that it was all about set pieces, only it's not a blockbuster. So the set pieces are smaller, you know. I could never connect to it, not once. Even though the filmmaking itself was strong, like I could see that the cinematography and the editing and all of this and the acting, I could see that all of those things were good, but in the same way that I can see that in something like The Revenant, but you're not like giving me anything of substance, you're just showing off that you have these skills, you know.
Wow.
I was really anti it, especially toward the end when it became like the Tomorrowland set, you know, beamed in.
Yeah, well, I feel like it's funny because I feel like that's when the movie did go for specificity, when I thought that they might leave it as vague, and I was grateful that they attempted to go there, and because I think it would have been easy to just be like, you know, end on a shot of like Kirsten Dunst's Spielberg face,
right?
And then it's just like, well, you imagine what it might have been, and like, well, no, we're there, you know. We're gonna go there. It doesn't work for me. The Tomorrowland stuff felt half baked or sort of something. It was just, it was off. It was not quite there. But I was glad that they attempted it. Nick, what about you? Where did you come down?
Yeah, I guess I was just sort of rooting for it the whole time, even though and was kind of interested in parts of it, but it did sort of feel like I was having a conversation with somebody who kept telling me what they weren't saying. I'm not doing this. I'm not doing this. I'm not an action thriller. I'm not suspenseful. Yeah. I'm not going to tell you about the kid. I'm not. Ooh, that was a special effects scene, but it wasn't super special effects. I'm not doing that. Like, I mean, okay, but like, let's do something at some point. Like, so I was interested in it, and I do. It was the movie that I taught with my film group last week, and like, it was right. Definitely one that talking about it with other people. Who'd reacted to it so differently made it even more kind of interesting to me. But I was at no point, like, hooked on it. Like, I super wanted to know what was going to happen. But yeah, I understand the detachment that you're talking about, Nathaniel.
Yeah, I mean, I think especially with, like, the cult stuff, and anytime you're dealing with the story of, like, powers...
Yeah,
you know, we get so much of that in film and television. You know, it's what everybody wants to fantasize about, I guess. But I really don't like it ever when it's so vague that I feel like any scene, something could happen that I couldn't have
seen coming.
Yeah, I couldn't have possibly imagined because I have no details about what the extent of the power is. Like, you know, stories you make up as you go along, and like there are, you don't even have to follow up on a power you saw in one scene because, well, we're just, you know, we're just riffing on what if someone had powers.
Well, one interview I read with him for that group, he was talking about. You know, he's just had a kid while developing this movie, and he was thinking about how many, both in his life but also in stories that we all consume, there's some weird kid whose parents or whose community eventually embrace that kid, but part of the embrace is always about
you know, you're not as different as you think you are. Like, we all have more in common than we have separate. And that the terms of the acceptance are kind of, even if they're not intended this way, they're kind of conditional in that way, right? Mm-hmm. And that he was like, some people have kids who, like, they are different. Like, I don't have any idea who my kid is. He might be completely different. So I wanted to make a story where, like, the kid's difference could just not be sanded down at any point. And you never get a hold on what makes him different than you, but you have to keep acting in his interest no matter what. Which I did think was kind of, I mean, there was a version of that that I would never have articulated that way that I liked in the movie, but reading it made me kind of think about the movie in a different way, I guess.
Yeah, the best parts of, sorry, go ahead, continue.
Well, and how he feels like, he also said that, you know, all of my movies have these extravagant, weird things happening to the characters, but in most of them, they just think they're practically problem-solving. Like, Michael Shannon's just trying to build a shelter, and his wife is just trying to get him to not do it, even though everything around that is so crazy and elaborate. And in this one, like, these parents are just trying to get a kid to a certain place and time.
Yeah.
And that's what they're focusing on. And so those kinds of... I don't really love it when, to be fully interested in a movie, I have to go home and read about what the creator's thoughts were. And he even kind of fesses up sometimes to not having a firm handle on the upshot here. But it has been interesting to think about. I wouldn't want to see it again.
Well, what was the reaction of your class or your group?
Three of them just loved it. Gaga loved it. And two of the three were completely surprised because this is not their genre.
Well, what did they love about it, though?
The number of things that they felt like it could mean to them, like one of them had really interpreted it as she watched the kid get sicker and sicker. She kind of experienced the whole thing as a story about having to say goodbye to your child who's dying and that it just has to be okay. And, that they are going somewhere else, hovering just above the earth or whatever it is that he says. And, thought it was a really, she liked the story as that, and watching parents kind of reconcile themselves to just having to lose a kid.
And, yeah, to me, that's the strongest part of the movie, is the stuff with Michael Shannon and Kirsten Dunst sort of coming to those terms. The scene near the end where the kid says to Michael Shannon, "You don't have to worry about me," and Michael Shannon says,
"It's my job," or something like that.
"I do have to worry about you. I like worrying about you."
Yes.
And that, like, brings home a lot that the story itself hadn't up until that point. And that it comes at such a late stage is interesting. But I thought that, to me, was, like, easily sort of the strongest stuff about it. Even the stuff with, like, Joel Edgerton, who in many ways feels like an extraneous character. But the sort of devotion he has to the kid, as sort of flimsily explained as it is, manifests itself fairly strongly in ways that I like. Go ahead.
He was the character that my eye was on the most. I was really kind of intrigued by him.
Right. Which is interesting because he really doesn't have a huge place in the story. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He feels like a little extra, and yet he's really compelling.
Whereas Kirsten Dunst
right.
has all kinds of reasons to be there. It's like, I'm so sad in this big sweater. Oh. And, I mean, we're already probably into spoiler territory, but there's that scene, because it felt like anything could happen in this movie, there's that scene where the two guys with the guns, you know, take out Joel Edgerton and Michael Shannon.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, wow, this is the moment when Kirsten is going to inherit the whole movie. Like, it's going to be on her to pull this all off.
Right.
And then, no.
Yeah. Well, and they sort of do that with Adam Driver, too, so sort of they build his character up and sort of have him enter the story, and then they literally leave him in a field.
See, this is my whole objection to it. It just seemed so random. Like, there was no point, I realize you have to make a million decisions to make a movie, but at no point did I feel like the decisions were firm, and this is the story we're telling. So I just...
Some ways felt like the season finale of a, like, one season miniseries of television, but that we only really, like, we didn't get the backup of the rest of it. I wanted to spend so much more time with the cult, because I always want to spend much more time in
with
movies
cults.
With cults, because I think, and apparently, like, this one especially seemed interesting in that it felt like a cult that had started being about one thing, and then this kid turned out to be the real deal, so now it's about something else. Mm-hmm. And, like, that was interesting to me, and I get that, like, movies can't follow every sort of avenue down, but that to me was intriguing.
I feel like your appetite for cults was informed by not having a drama club in high school? Like,
yeah.
Searching for that the whole time.
I've been longing for something to belong to this
fill
whole
that hole. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, something else I will say I liked about it, even though this is, again, like having to sort of overthink the movie, but I liked that there was like the government, the cult, the family.
Yeah.
All these different factions that had totally sort of opposed motives within the context of the story, but actually all of them were kind of right about the kid. Like, he was a security risk. He did need to be put in that place, and he was kind of worth making a huge fuss over. And it was kind of cool to see a story where nobody really, except arguably the two kind of bounty hunters, get sort of classified as the wrongdoers, or as having not gotten it, whereas these people get it. I liked that about it.
Yeah, it felt like everybody was coming from their sort of most rational place.
Mm-hmm. I think I would have liked the movie a little bit more, and this is going to be it would never get made, and it would make, like, 2 cents. But I kind of felt it would have been stronger if it had left, like, if you're going to be as vague as the movie was, if it had left a question mark around the kid, a bigger question mark around the kid. Like, are people projecting all of this onto him? Like, because we see very, very early in the movie that he has superpowers.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the idea of cults in general and people being lifted up as the special or the chosen one or, you know, whatever, is that it's all based on what people believe, but there's no, you know, whether or not it's true, you know, you can't prove, which is the whole thing, because it's like circular logic with faith, you know? So I thought, I just kind of like, to me, that's more interesting than, oh, you know, superpowers.
Hmm.
See, to me, I thought the opposite, in that I've seen that sort of, that movie, that TV show where you know, everything is left sort of a question, and then, you know, you get to the end of the movie and it's like, but maybe. And I liked the fact that this movie sort of stuck, you know, planted a stake in the ground and was like, this is true. This is, he's got powers. This is what's happening. And where do we go from there?
Yeah, I mean, I would have been fine with that if I had felt it was specific in any way, but since it was going to be so vague,
sure,
I thought it would be more interesting if it was totally vague.
Right.
I'm kind of with Joe, though. Like, I felt like that tension, I mean, there wasn't a ton I really loved about the end, except the insistence that he really is completely something else than the rest of us. And I get why, like, it seems odd to, like, be that firm on that point and then not really explore it, or even have maybe the 10 more minutes of the movie that show us something about how the world reacts to the fact that this thing just happened that, you know, nobody has information about, but there was a fucking city happening.
Over the entire southeastern United States, yeah.
Yeah. But I agree, Joe, with you that the sort of conviction to not sort of put this on the possible craziness of the characters or the sheer capacity for projection, I thought was kind of cool and unusual.
It's similar to how I liked the end of Safety Not Guaranteed, even though I didn't like the entire movie of Safety Not Guaranteed, because I was like, oh, well, they went there. They answered the question, and I wasn't expecting them to.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you need the whole movie to be good as well.
You're so picky.
I know.
Yeah, you're completely demanding and ridiculous.
It's so hard to please.
I am very... I like Jeff Nichols is a director who I, like, really respect and admire, even though I hadn't up until a week or so ago ever seen a movie of his that I fully liked. And then I saw Shotgun Stories, because it's on Amazon Prime. And I was like, oh, this is the one. This is the one that, like, fully works.
Oh, interesting.
Isn't that his first one?
It's his first one, yeah. So I was very happy to have sort of seen a movie that I was able to give myself over to. And I have, like, a weird sort of push-pull relationship with Michael Shannon's performances, and I really like that one. I liked him in Midnight Special a lot, too. And yet not so much in Take Shelter, which is the one that everybody really loved him in. So he's quite the muse for Nichols. And I like that Nichols has a movie coming out at the end of the year, where, like, Midnight Special seemed like it you know, was a little bit of a disappointment, not just for us, but, like, for everybody. I feel like people were poised to really get to an Ex Machina place with Midnight Special, and it didn't happen, I think, for reasons that, you know, the movie wasn't as good. But that Loving is coming out by the end of the year.
And opening at Cannes.
And opening at Cannes, yeah, exactly. Like, that's, I'm very, you know, interested in what that movie does.
Well, I'm probably in the same place with him. Like, I'm usually curious about his movies, but I haven't really ever liked them. And I haven't seen Shotgun Stories.
I haven't seen that one either, so that makes me really interested. I rewatched Take Shelter before the film group and liked it better than I had the first time. But then I also watched Close Encounters again for the first time since I was in college. And it didn't really help Midnight Special to see how many things felt pretty directly transposed in a lot of ways. Even though I understand that Midnight Special is also kind of interested in whether you can tell that kind of story at a totally more modest scale, which is kind of interesting about it. But up against what Spielberg was attempting, it looked a little imitative, but also a little small.
Yeah. I could see that.
I love Close Encounters.
You guys, let's all watch Close Encounters.
It's one of the only Spielbergs that I love unreservedly.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Jinx.
We both think you're interesting. Well, I love
it. Yeah.
So what else have you guys been seeing? I think we've seen very different things.
I think we have. Well, we were trying to plan this out, and we only really converged on the one movie that all three of us had seen. Have you guys seen...
Is that my fault because I haven't seen anything? Like,
no, but yeah, I looked at your list, though, Nick, and I hadn't seen most of those. You've screened this year.
Most of those I saw, like, at Toronto or Chicago last year. Like, I just haven't been in the theater much lately. But, like, Doris, for example, that was another one that I couldn't quite make myself buy a ticket for, and maybe I should have.
I think you should give it a shot. I was very skeptical of it from the trailers and then even from the first, like, 20 minutes of it. And this was knowing that, like, people I sort of know and respect had seen it and really liked it. But it's a movie that, like, my guard was up for the first maybe, like, 20, 25 minutes, and I was worried that it was going to be a movie that, you know, makes its bones by mocking its central character. And it doesn't turn out to be that way. And it goes about that. It also doesn't sort of sanctify her or make her into this just sort of, like, there's just something about Doris, like, that kind of thing. And I liked the I liked the balance that it kept with her. And I'm generally pro Sally Field in all her little sort of quirks and
me too. I'm
that kind of thing. I like that kind of thing that she projects.
I'm pretty much a fan of hers, so, like, I was the right audience for it, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah,
it's
light and it's sort of
awkward at moments, like the storytelling and the script and stuff, but I thought she was really good, and
she is. She's really good. I feel like we get that Golden Globe slot now where it's like, oh, the actress of a certain age in an indie comedy, where, although this year there's a lot of competition.
Yeah, I was going to say Susan Sarandon, The Meddler.
Now. And whenever Shirley MacLaine's movie opens, you know, whether that turns out to be something for that category as well. It certainly seems like it from just the poster Shirley and Jessica Lange are being like old broads on the road. Okay, I'll do it.
But isn't it fun to have these choices? Like, to have more than one option?
Absolutely. Even last year we had that with, like, Lily Tomlin and Blythe Danner. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I like that this has become something of a reliable indie micro genre that will make, you know, at least a little bit of money.
Well, since Hollywood's not interested in the, you know, mid-budget stuff anymore.
Right, right.
It has to show up somewhere else, and the audience is still there for it, just maybe not in record-breaking numbers.
Sure, exactly.
They are not niche. Audiences want to see them, and in fact, they make money. The world is round, people.
Oh, God. So glad that we can count on you for the verbatim. The verbatim Oscar speech.
In Fahrenheit 451, when that happens, this will be my job.
The archivist.
Sooner than you think. Yeah. Well, I should talk. I'm the one who wrote an entire blog post last week about the way Ingrid Bergman pronounces every word when announcing the Best Actress tie from 1968. But, like, it's burned into my brain the way she, like, sort of, like, touches at her face and is so, like, delighted. It's the best.
The thick description of that.
The what?
The thick description. You really had your field notes down.
I did. Well, and then she calls it the lion, or Lion in the Winter, which is
great. It's just sort of lovely
and endearing. She's the best. God love her. Anyway, hello, my name is Doris. One thing I really liked was the way it kind of reverse engineered comedy that pokes fun at hipsters, in that you sort of get to it backwards, in that, oh no, Sally Field doesn't have to dress like hipsters. Sally Field is like a batty old hoarder lady from Staten Island. She already dresses like hipsters. Like, this is, they're basically dressing like her at this point. Like, I liked that. I thought that was kind of cute. And that's a movie, too. Speaking of endings, I think that's a movie that comes at an ending where I was very nervous that they were going to end it in the wrong way. Mm-hmm. And they pull their feet out of the fire and ended it at a really sort of lovely moment, which I liked.
Yeah, I think it's good.
They had to. That's a movie that sort of has to be very careful when you're talking about this sort of May-December, mm-hmm. in her character's eyes, a romance between her and Max Greenfield's character. And I think you end up walking a line between being too dismissive of her, and yet you don't want to be condescending going the other way and mm-hmm. sort of, you know, talk, you know, paint the relationship as just sort of like, oh, like, you know, of course this could happen because, you know, she's a beautiful soul and whatnot. And it's just like, it kept its feet in the real world while sort of showing kindness to both of those mm-hmm. characters, which was very important to me.
Well, I mean, I've heard people complain that he's unrealistic, but I kind of object to that because, A, it's a comedy, so right. Everything's slightly heightened and odd and, you know, possible subject of joking.
Right.
But also, people in work environments, like, yes. I realize some work environments are, you know, generationally specific, but a lot of them have people of all ages in them. And people's relationships to people that they work with can be outside of their normal comfort zones in social interactions.
Yeah, well,
and they can actually become friends.
Yeah, and they do a good job of establishing that character as being an outsider at the beginning anyway. So, yeah, I don't think it comes across to me as unrealistic. And in fact, I think they take good pains to sort of make sure that they are not making him too much of a this sort of, you know, idealized character. Like, he ends up reacting to things in a very realistic way.
Can I ask you guys one more question as the non-ticket buyer of late? Uh-huh.
Yes.
Let's say I was going to go see The Jungle Book or Zootopia.
Zootopia.
When do I go to?
Zootopia.
I've only seen Zootopia of the two of them, and I really liked Zootopia.
And you've seen both, Daniel?
Yeah, I've seen both. Jungle Book is very, you know, technologically, like, it'll get nominated for visual effects, I'm sure. But it's really just a rehash. Like, it's just a live-action version of the animated movie, basically.
Okay. Down to, like, some of the songs, right?
Yeah, two of the songs are still in it. And Trust in Me is, like, worked into the score, even though Scarlett doesn't sing it until the credits.
Oh, she sings it over the credits.
That's, yeah. So, So it's basically got the three hits, or what, if you will, from the movie worked into it. Right. And to me, like, if you're gonna be a musical, be a musical. Like, it seems very, it approaches those sections very sort of awkwardly, because it's like, oh, somebody's gonna sing, but it's not a musical. So we're gonna
don't
talk,
go anywhere.
Yeah, so we're gonna talk, sing. All it was very awkward to me, but it, you know, but Zootopia is legitimately good. Like, it's really, really funny, and it has lots of movie spoofs and other things in it, without being one of those anachronistic, you know.
Yeah, there's a lot more going on in Zootopia, as has been written about. So it's sort of like, it's not going to surprise you now, but it's more than I feel like the typical animated movie, in that it has a lot on its mind, which is pretty great. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's all the time we have for boys. So before we go, I want to hear everybody's favorite Prince song. Farewell to Prince.
I know. I'm going to be really boring because it's Purple Rain. Nothing's better than Purple Rain. No. With much love to Little Red Corvette, because that's the first song I ever sang on karaoke.
Oh.
Special place in my heart.
That's awesome.
You know I can't commit. Little Red Corvette, Erotic City, Kiss, Scarlet Pussy.
Wow.
Those are four.
Those are all the new Avengers in Captain America Civil War. So.
Bring it back to the cinema. Excited. Love it.
What about you?
Well, I always have to put Purple Rain to the side, because I think the entire record is perfect. Like,
I see.
From start to finish. So my favorite is Let's Pretend We're Married.
It's a good pick.
With Delirious as my runner-up.
We will miss you, Prince.
Thanks for tuning in. Go see Everybody Wants Some. Which is slightly polarizing. We've had two reviews on the site. One person loved it, one person did not like it at all. But I vote
see it and decide for yourself.
I vote yay.
Were they both you, just to keep things interesting?
No, I didn't write a review of it. I only tried that once, with Notes on a Scandal, writing two reviews parallel.
That was so brilliant.
Oh, I'm going to go watch Notes on a Scandal, you guys. Bye.
Here I am. Do you say that when you put it in the DVD player? Do you say that every time?
Yes. I first have to really smudge my eyeliner, though. So, yeah.